Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and says, well done, England, or sack Gareth Southgate, it's a disgrace. I'm Kevin Day, and here's Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. And full disclosure here, Kieran, the reason we are hedging our bets on England is that we are recording this on Friday because, as my dear departed mum used to say, the Baroness has put her foot down with a heavy hand.
She certainly has. As I've worked 7 days a week for, I've lost track how long, we had one of those conversations, which was sort of, you got the look and the tone, and I thought, right, I've got a lot of making up to do.
Yeah, that's fine, perfectly understandable, as long as the Baroness realises that if the England game ends with Gareth Southgate setting fire to a pile of cash and running around a pitch shouting amortisation is fake news, then this pod is in a ton of trouble, Kieran. it's questions day, but we start with some news. One news story, and can you guess, girls and boys, which club it's about? Can you? Can you all have a guess? Shall we all shout it together? 1, 2, 3. But Kieran, it's actually, I think, for the first time in some months, good news for fans of Derby County.
Yes, the EFL has decided not to appeal the recent judgment, which was to give Derby a £100,000 fine and submit their accounts. There was a danger that the EFL could have tried to force through some form of judgment, which would have resulted in a points deduction being assigned effectively retrospectively for 21. For season 2021, and that would have caused huge problems. It was never really practical. So Derby do have to resubmit their calculations according to the EFL. I think it would be good if both of those parties who have been firing shots at each other through websites, just said, ultimately, don't we love football because of football and not because of amortization? Perhaps it will give both sides of the debate a bit of breathing space. So the EFL have said on their website that now that the written explanations from the committee have been published, they have taken them on board. They're not going to appeal. I think it's noticeable that Derby are just keeping their powder dry, just getting on with it now, which, again, no triumphalism. It's the way to go forward, and let's hope that they can resolve their differences.
It's what worries me, Kieran, and of course I fully understand why the Baroness is doing this, but I'm worried that Derby fans listening to this on Monday will be going, good news, it's good news, and they'll go, that's 3 days ago. They'll be expecting new good news, and it will just be, there won't be any Derby fans who suddenly who are getting that news broken to them on a pod. That's all. Just fine. Just bide your time to mention that to her, Kieran. Maybe, maybe three espresso martinis in. Hand the phone over.
I'll pass her over to you.
Yes, if you could. That's the plan. And that sound you could hear in the background was me sneezing because we're recording in the evening, just as the pollen falls gently to the ground via my hay fever. questions, Kieran. Our first question, but that's fine. The Baroness isn't to know that I'm better in the morning. I say mornings, 11 o'clock-ish is roughly, which is lunchtime for you, isn't it, basically? first question comes from Nick Pooley. And Nick says, in club accounts, when reviewing the sums paid in wages, does this include all fees paid to players, including bonuses such as appearance fees, goals, bonuses, etc., or are those accounted for separately?
Well, Nick is absolutely right. As far as the financial statements published by the accounts are concerned, there is a single figure for wages. And that includes not just playing staff, but non-playing staff as well. So therefore, it includes all bonuses. So therefore, when people say, well, is it due to the fact that the clubs who are paying big wages seem to win all the time? There's a certain circularity to that argument, because by winning all the time, they end up paying bigger bonuses, so therefore they end up with a bigger wage bill. So, it's a classic chicken and egg situation, but clearly some clubs have bigger budgets than others. The only numbers which are extracted for sort of individual review are those of the board of directors. So the highest paid director, his or her pay will appear explicitly as far as the finances are concerned. But those for individual players, including bonuses, are not shown.
Okay, David Holliday has our next question. And David Holliday says, there's been talk at Leeds recently. And we have such a backlog of questions, Kieran. I was slightly worried this might be about Billy Bremner, this question. but it turns out, no, there's been talk at Leeds recently that Pablo Hernandez will leave in the summer, probably, most likely, to CD Castellón in Spain, which is his hometown. However, Hernandez is also an owner of that club. So will any transfer have to be negotiated between Pablo and Pablo while we wait to hear whether Mr. Hernandez has agreed terms with Mr. Hernandez? And what's to stop players buying into clubs and then moving to them cut price to help them out?
Right. If we answer the second question first, players and agents are not allowed to have ownership rights in relation to football clubs. And that brings us on to our very good friends at Swindon Town, because there was accusations of some form of closet ownership by Gareth Barry of Swindon Town, but that could not be put in writing because that would have been in breach of FA regulations. So there are rules to stop this taking place, and those rules are rightly there, because otherwise you could have conflicts of interest taking place. In respect of Pablo Hernandez and his relationship with Castellón, his family run a sports shop in the town. He does seem, you know, completely embedded into the town himself. And the reason why he invested money in was in terms of the previous owners. I'm not saying that they are wrong'uns, but I did some investigation, and one of them was called Sergio Dale. further ferreting around in the small print, it turned out that they seemed to be invoicing the club for some of their services where they didn't appear to do anything, and in respect of transfers, the amount of money being paid, let's say they sold a player for £5 million, well, you know, €5 million, perhaps only £3 million of that would ever end up in the books of the club. So there have been historic issues to do with the ownership and governance of the club, and the Hernandez family, stalwarts of the town that they are, came to the rescue along with others. He's not a majority owner as such, so he would not therefore be responsible for negotiating his remuneration or anything. And I think what they would try to do was to ring fence his relationship, if that's a playing relationship, in terms of any form of ownership. But we do see quite a lot of football clubs moving into the realm of ownership. Clearly we've got David Beckham is got Inter Miami. I think Ronaldinho or Ronaldo owns a football club, because and Didier Drogba is getting involved. We've just seen Peter Crouch taking on a director's role at Dulwich Hamlet. You know, many footballers are still so in love with the game that they want a slightly greater relationship with individual clubs.
So Castellón legend Pablo Hernandez owns a sports shop in the town, and Swindon legend Don Rogers owns a sports shop in Swindon. It's wheels within wheels.
Indeed. Yeah,
that's the sort of thing Swiss Ramble wouldn't notice. He's got less time on his hands, to be perfectly honest, Kieran. That's why. Our next question comes from Tim Perkins. And Tim Perkins says, my daughter, in brackets, who has no interest in football, close brackets, asked me if ITV sponsored any football teams. I said no, but it made me think, as an advertiser themselves, could ITV sponsor a club shirt and then resell the shirt front every week to a different show? So Love Island, Britain's Got Talent, Coronation Street, etc. Would the club entertain quick designs regularly, and how would kit manufacturers feel? Tim is clearly a better father than I am, because if my daughter I'd ask that question. And I said, what's it got to do with you? You don't like football. And simply refused to answer it. but no, Tim's much nicer. He said to his daughter, well, I don't know, but I'll know somebody who will. I'll email Price of Football.
Yes.
So, it's an interesting question, though, because also while I'd like your comment on this as well, Kieran, because it must be quite annoying for BBC and ITV executives that every time they interview an England player or manager during the tournament, there's a huge BT logo stuck on the front of the player or manager shirt.
Yes, yeah, but I guess that's just showbiz these days, and BT have paid a very large sum of money to the Football Association for that privilege. So I'm sure they feel that they're, especially with the, well, hopefully, England going forwards to the semi-finals, when this is listened to, they're getting plenty of exposure. But in terms of Tim's question, manufacturers would hate this because you'd have to do lots of production runs. So that wouldn't be too great from their point of view. They it's not a huge issue in the sense, we've seen in respect of the matches at the European Championships that individual shirts actually say this match is for England versus Scotland or Belgium versus Portugal. A little bit of sewing won't go remiss. But the manufacturers would not be keen on this because they are looking to sell the shirts to fans.
Yeah.
So if you were going to have potentially 15 or 16 different sponsors in a season, which sponsor would you choose for the merchandise which was sold to the fans? And also, people when they buy a football shirt, they like to feel that they've got something which is sort of quasi real. And if you are wearing 3 weeks ago sponsor, then it might put you off. Part of the reason why people do buy football kits every season is that there are relatively small changes. Yeah, we know that Palace are going to play in red and blue. We know that Manchester United are going to play in red. We know that Spurs are going to play in white and blue shorts. And quite often the sponsor's name will roll over from season to season, but there'll be very subtle changes and you feel that you have to go and buy it. Well, if this was to happen on a home match by home match basis, then I think the fans would get pretty fed up. I mean, there will, of course, blokes being blokes, there will be some completists who will buy every single one, but I suspect there'll be relatively few and far between. Looking at the rules, I think that you are allowed to change sponsor during the season. But it's a bit like players. You shouldn't really be, for what I can make out, you can't change those on a regular basis. You're also allowed, even if you have an ongoing sponsorship deal, you are allowed to effectively gift one match a season to a charity. So we've quite often seen this, and that's a fantastic gesture by the clubs. But also looking at the rules, and I did do again a bit of ferreting around here. That there's nothing to stop you having different sponsors for different competitions. So you could have one sponsor for the FA Cup, one sponsor for the Carabao Cup, one sponsor for the Papa John's, and so on. But of course, that might just be for one match. Depending on how far you get in the competition, and we do see different rules from UEFA to the Premier League and the EFL, well, the Premier League itself, in terms of what is acceptable and unacceptable. So until the 1st of July 2021, for example, you weren't allowed to have shirt sleeve sponsors in respect. So the rules and the small print in football do change, because I was looking at the latest updates from the EFL itself. One of the big loopholes that clubs have had historically, or for the last 4 or 5 years, is the ability to sell their stadiums and keep the profits in FFP calculations. And as of the 1st of July 2021, that is now outlawed. So hats off to the EFL for pushing that one through.
Yeah, I have to say shirt sleeve sponsorship is the thin end of the wedge as far as I'm concerned. Give it another couple of seasons, we'll be looking like French teams. I don't want that to happen. Every single bit of the kit's going to be covered in some garish colour with a sponsor. My problem with Tim Perkins and his daughter's suggestion here, that it's bad enough seeing a 20-stone Palace fan squeezed into a medium-sized shirt with Terry 65 on the back as it is, without having Love Island emblazoned across the front as well. Because that's the one, blokes, as you say, blokes being blokes, that's the one they'd go for. They'd have Love Island. They'd go, oh, that could be me. Just drop a couple of stones.
Well, it's better than loose women. You wouldn't want that across the front of your shirt, would you?
There's at least two of them I definitely wouldn't want. Oh, I see what you're saying, yes. that's a loud corridor, the loose women corridor. My God, the production corridor for loose women. The Have I Got News For You corridor used to be next to the production corridor for loose women. Ours was more sedate, let's put it that way. Our next question comes from Kieran Williams. And Kieran says, bit of a mad one here that's come about from a partially intoxicated Saturday evening footy watch. Is there any other sort? Yes, fully intoxicated. Kieran says, is it possible for a team to loan a player and then subsequently loan that same player out themselves? And what if the parent club recalled that player from the initial club, if you're paying attention, but the subsequent loan doesn't have a recall option? Many thanks for appeasing my strange hypotheticals. You're welcome, Kieran Williams. But remember, drink responsibly, although not quite as responsibly as Kieran Maguire. Kieran takes it too far. Well, I'm not drinking at all. It's an interesting one. It's one I've never thought of. Is it possible to loan a player and then loan that player out?
No, the registration of the player always belongs to the host club, and therefore they can dictate what happens with regards to that registration. So they would be in a position to approve or deny any subsequent actions. There's nothing to stop a player from returning to the parent club and then being loaned out again in the same season. Yeah. But remember, you are restricted to only playing for two clubs within a season. So if you couldn't, I think it would be very difficult to have a sublet of a sublet, as it were. So the football authorities would be very uncomfortable about that, because the reason why we actually have transfer windows, if we go back historically, was there was a genuine fear that you could get to 3 or 4 weeks from the end of the season and you've got a club in mid-table who's got two superb players, and then you could hire those out for either somebody who was seeking to get to get a trophy or to avoid relegation. So that's why there are quite actually these days very significant restrictions. And also, just going back to Tim Perkins' questions, in relation to kits and sponsors, if he really wants to entertain his daughter, I have a copy of the UEFA rules in relation to what you can and cannot do in terms of the contents of a kit, in terms of how big the sponsor logos and so on. And it goes on for 65 pages.
Wow, really?
Yes.
Goodness.
That's an evening and a half.
I think we've already established, Kieran, that Tim Perkins' daughter has no interest in football, so I can't imagine the circumstances by which her introduction to the game would come by the 65-page UEFA rule on sponsorship sizes. But you never know. Why don't we send it? Tim, get in touch with an email address, and we will email you the 65-page UEFA rules. And let us know how that goes.
Yes.
Our next question comes from Jack Munton. And Jack, I hope you're listening, because I want to congratulate you, because I suspect this may well be one of Kieran's favourite questions, certainly of the year so far. This is a proper accountant's question. And also, I don't know why, Jack, but somehow I just get the feeling, the way this question bristled on the page even, I think Jack is probably unhappy with spurious lightweight questions. He doesn't like the sort of things. He probably doesn't like the sort of alleyways we get down. I imagine, like last week when we were talking about Smith's lyrics, Jack's going, come on, it's meant to be about accounting, this pod. What are you doing? But Jack says, the new IR35 legislation came into effect in April for contractors engaging with businesses using their own limited companies. Is this likely to affect many professional footballers?
Right. For people not familiar with the rules, the IR35 rules were introduced to try to prevent employers classifying people as employees. And this had implications in terms of tax rates, national insurance, holiday pay, and so on. And there have been a number of test cases in relation to this. And we move on now from Loose Women to Lorraine Kelly, who very successfully defended the HMRC's claim that she was an employee of ITV because I think, didn't she say that she was playing the part of a person called Lorraine Kelly rather than being Lorraine Kelly herself, which which is intriguing. The rules are constantly being tweaked by HMRC, and in relation to players, they do have contracts of employment with their club. So in terms of their main forms of income, I don't think there's going to be any change there because they have the employer and employee relationship. But in terms of their image rights, I think this is more intriguing. But the thing is with image rights is that quite often the players will have things such as boot contracts. So you know, would Marcus Rashford or Raheem Sterling, you know, would they therefore become employees of the likes of Puma and Nike and New Balance and so on? That will be one for their legal team to pursue. But I think they will be able to say, well, hold on, I've actually got a contract of employment with somebody else. In terms of the clubs potentially paying, you know, up to 20% of the agreed remuneration to an image rights company, and that is located overseas or that's located in a way which is more tax efficient, it could be that that HMRC might start to come after the football industry with banners aloft and trying to force this through, because I certainly when I speak to the revenue they say we're not happy about it, we've got an agreement but we don't think we can go any further. So this one will run and run. At present, I think the players are in a strong position because they tend to be represented by people who know the small print extremely well. At present, okay. Future, we'll have to wait and see.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
So is this related to, Kieran, or the flip side of the argument that Uber drivers, for example, want to be employees? Is it a similar issue?
Yes. I mean, the reason why you might want to be classified as self-employed and put your money through a company is that I've seen people put their children in as directors of the company and take money out as dividends and use their kids' tax-free allowance. So there's lots of efficiencies to be used. Now, if you're an Uber driver, the chances are that you are not in that level of income where you're necessarily, if you're an Uber driver who's earning enough money to be paying tax at 45%, I wouldn't want to get in your car because you're probably driving 26 hours a day. But from the Uber driver's perspective, they want some form of protection, and there are protections as employees that you get. Equally, if you are a contractor and you're flitting from company to company, you normally see yourself as a self-employed. The rules were introduced because they were being abused, way back in the past. Has the dial moved too far in favor of the revenue? I teach at other universities, and I say, well, yeah, I'm not an employee of you, but they say, well, as far as we're concerned, you are, and you know, and they deduct tax at source, and right. that's fine as far as I'm concerned. But you know, I'd rather keep my affairs in just one particular box.
Oh, those were the days when my tax was deducted at source. So much easier then, Kieran, isn't it? You don't have to think about putting it away somewhere and separating tax and VAT. Oh, it's not my fault, Kieran. It's the world. It's against me. it's the system, man. It's not me.
The world won't listen. And we're back to Smith's references, of course.
Jack Munson's going to be tutting away. Jack Munson, we had a brilliant 5 minutes of proper accountancy, and they're straight back into the leading Smiths. Phil Shortland has an interesting question. Phil Shortland's question goes thus. Bolton Wanderers are obliged to pay their unsecured creditors around £3.5 million in July as a result of the deal the current owners made with the administrator, 35 pence in the pound, says Phil. The penalty for non-payment would be a 15-point deduction and potentially, of course, liquidation. At a recent supporters' trust meeting, the CEO said the club were on course to meet the obligation using an, and I quote, asset purchase agreement, but didn't explain what that was, and no one seems to know either. Can you explain what an asset purchase agreement is?
Right. An asset purchase agreement is simply effectively a contract between two parties which sets out the terms for a buyer and a seller. And it will agree a price. It will say this is exactly what you're getting for the money involved. It will set out whether there's any warranties involved. So from reading Phil's question, I'm reading it that whilst there is an asset purchase agreement, that Bolton Wanderers are potentially on the selling side of this, and therefore they have an agreement with somebody to buy some assets from them, right, and they will use the proceeds of that, right, the sale of that asset to meet their obligations to the unsecured creditors to ensure that there isn't a further points deduction. So that's my understanding. I've been going on to various law websites and bits and pieces, and that's what it certainly sort of the general term asset purchase agreement is. You know, we are going to agree to sell you X for, you know, Y pounds, and this is exactly what you're getting. And if something's wrong with the asset, these are the consequences.
Right, but this is not something that your spidey senses are tingling over. There's no indication that Bolton are unable to meet their obligations.
No. I mean, Bolton's accounts came out a few days ago. I mean, they had a tough year under the new ownership, but you know, the new ownership do seem to be committed. The new ownership have got nothing to do with Ken Anderson, and don't get me started with that. He makes Steve Dale look like a vicar.
Yeah.
I think they've got the right people with the right intentions, but it doesn't mean that it's an easy ride. Coming out, people think that administration coming out of it because you come out of it effectively with a clean slate in terms of your creditors, apart from, you know, under the football rules, which I think are great. It does stop spurious administrations. Yeah. You've still got a lot of work to do, because if you take over a football club, it's already losing money.
Yeah. Ian Hutchins, I presume, is a West Brom fan, because Ian says, over the last couple of seasons, West Brom have had quite a few players pick up serious injuries whilst out on loan. And Ian said, I was wondering, do the club who borrowed the player continue to be responsible for the player's wages and paying for treatment, even if the player returns to the parent club for treatment before going back to complete the loan? And of course, if only Palace had loaned Nathan Ferguson rather than bought somebody who was injured when we bought him and is still injured 15 months later, which is fairly typical Palace. But it's an interesting question, isn't it? I know it's one we've sort of talked about before, but that angle of what happens if a player goes back to the parent club for treatment and then goes back to the loan club is an interesting twist.
Yeah, I think in terms of wages, the loan club is obliged to pick them up regardless of where the treatment is taking right. place. It could be that if you are the parent club, especially if you are, say, a Premier League club and you've loaned a player out to League One or League Two, you might feel that your physio facilities are in the best interest of the player and yeah, therefore the parent club in the long term. So therefore, you're quite happy to pick up the tab in terms of medical treatment, but the other club would still be obliged to pay the wages because they've signed a contract to that effect, and you know it's part of sporting risk and sporting chance when the player gets on the field of play that he may got injured. And therefore, the team for whom he's playing for at the time is obliged to carry on paying him. Mm. Yeah, but remember, you're not necessarily paying him 100% of his wages to begin with.
Yes. Our next question comes from Tony Bruno Bouchard. And Tony says, I'm a fan of the pod from Montreal in Canada. Hello, Montreal in Canada. Recently, there were rumours that Bournemouth were interested in signing our manager Thierry Henry, and it got me wondering how transfer fees for managers work. I know that player contracts are considered assets and are amortised, thanks to your show. You're welcome. But what about managers? Is it the same, and what is fair transfer value? Well, before we start, Kieran, I have a question for you, Tony, and that is Les Foufous d'Electrique still open in Montreal? Because I had a very happy few days there one night. It was on my mate's honeymoon, as it happened. He took his two best mates with one honeymoon to Montreal. It's a long story.
What did Missy say?
She was, I don't think she was over. Let's just leave it at not over the moon, shall we? let's say not 100% delighted with the arrangements, but his argument was that we had travelled a long way for the wedding, and it seemed a bit unfair for us not to carry. She didn't quite see that, but Le Foufou d'Electrique is. I've got some very happy memories of that. So if Tony can reassure me it's still open, I'd be delighted to hear that. And in the meantime, Kieran, if you could answer his question about what's happening in the background, that Kieran, is doors opening? Is somebody?
So my four-legged friend was trying to escape into the room.
Escape into the room. That's a
move on.
Is he wondering why? This will give away when we're recording this. He's probably wondering why you're not watching extra time between Spain and
exactly. Yes.
Is he trying to communicate like Lassie? He's trying to tell you what the score is. Finley, yes. Daddy's got his phone on. It's fine. He doesn't need you to tell him. Anyway, the question: the transfer fees and what constitutes a fair transfer value for a manager? That's an interesting question.
Well, there will be written into the manager's contract, there will be a compensation fee because you do not own the manager's registration. When you're signing a player, you're actually signing his registration certificate, which means that he can play for the club that's signing him and that club only. Oh. There are no such rules in respect of managers. Oh. But if a manager has a contract which has X months, X years remaining, then a club potentially acquiring him would have to pay up the remainder of the contract, usually as compensation. So when Marco Silva went to Everton from Watford, for example, and Watford's accounts have come out in the last 48 hours. It's been a busy time because the 30th of June just passed. Watford have said in their accounts that we received £4.5 million in compensation. That is not amortized. That is simply put through as a cost. If you take a look at Chelsea's accounts since Roman Abramovich arrived, the amount of individual costs in what they simply call management compensation, and that's the costs A of sacking managers, which clearly Roman's quite keen on, but also recruiting managers, you know, like Villas-Boas, whatever his name is. He cost them an absolute fortune to recruit from his existing club, and then he was sacked within a few months. So I believe Chelsea's total management compensation fees in the Abramovich regime are around about £80 million, which even for a man as wealthy as him, that's going to make at least a small dent in his finances. How is the fair transfer value determined? It's normally linked to the remaining length of contract. There could be specific clauses in the contract which says if the club is approached to release the manager from the contract, there will be X amount of compensation being paid. I know that there were rumours that Graham Potter might be going to Spurs, and he still got 4.5 years remaining on a contract. So I think the compensation was somewhere in the region of £15 to £20 million, and that's why they went elsewhere for a manager.
Please don't throw references to manager recruitment around willy-nilly like that, Kieran. It's a slightly sore point for us Palace fans at the moment. Unless, of course, by Monday morning when this is going out, Jose Mourinho has changed his mind and signed for Palace.
I thought it was Patrick Vieira's blue and red army.
Possibly with Brian Kidd coming to join him for Manchester City as well. You know what? I'm reaching the age where the only thing that really worries me about a new manager is whether his name will scan with Red and Blue Army. As you really don't want a manager whose name you can't cram into Red and Blue Army. This idea, Kieran, that you're not signing a manager's registration, I know it's unlikely then, but could Sean Dyche say, by the way, in my days off, I'm going to keep managing the local Sunday team as a favour? Because, remember in the old days, the 70s and 80s, a player nearly, one player per team would manage a Sunday team. Is there anything to stop a manager doing that then?
Not at all.
Really?
The contract of employment will be very specific in terms of the obligations of the manager. But, managing a local Sunday team, it's the equivalent if he wants to go out, crocheting or, helicoptering, whatever. What you do in your own time is your own business as an employee.
Yeah, that's very much says something about the county in which you live, Kieran, that your two parameters were crochet and helicopters there. That's very much a Sussex choice there, is it? Sure. I don't know, darling, what do you reckon? Crochet or helicopter? Well, the vineyard's shut for the afternoon, so I don't know. Jacob Davis has our penultimate question. Jacob, this is an interesting question, actually, a very interesting comparison. How much do Sky Sports pay to show the Northern Irish Premiership, and how does that compare to the amount BT pays to show non-league games in England?
Right, trying to get the numbers here are proving to be difficult stroke impossible, but I know that there was a proposal to have an all-Ireland league where they felt that they would be able to get £1 million a year for the TV rights. So to put that in context, the EFL deal is worth £119 million a year, and the Premier League deal is worth around about £3,000 million a year. £3 billion a year. So I think we would be talking tens of thousands. If they get 100,000, then they're probably doing well. And it's the same with BT and non-league. It simply doesn't generate sufficient viewing figures to warrant paying large fees. So if we take a look at clubs in League Two, the EFL TV deal works out as around about 250, 300 grand per club. And then they get solidarity payments from the Premier League as well. When you drop out of that into non-league, I think the clubs there are, if they get 10 grand a year from TV, they'd be doing extremely well.
Why is it difficult to get the numbers on the Northern Irish deal, Kieran? Is this not a matter of public record?
No, it's a private contract between the two parties, and simply that there's not enough interest in it from a publicity perspective.
Okay.
If you look at Sky Sports, it is a very broad church in terms of sports, and whilst we tend to know how much they've agreed to pay for rugby or cricket or football, that's for the more niche sports, the numbers involved, they practically give the rights away for nothing, because at least they're getting a bit of publicity for their sponsors. Yeah. I remember in the early days of Sky, you used to get that monthly magazine, and I thought, oh, there's this show here in Sky called Water Sports World, and I got very excited about that. And it turned out to be about powerboat racing, and I was absolutely gutted. I thought it might have been a German import or something like that.
Well, to be fair, Kieran, you were only 7 at the time. You couldn't reach the top shelf at that stage. Our final question comes from Kev Heller. And Kev says that my club, his club, St Johnstone, are widely regarded as one of, if not the best run club in Scotland. Is this still the case? And how long can we carry on punching above our weight with COVID-19 and a relatively small support base?
Well, I mean, Kev is absolutely right. I've got St Johnstone's accounts in front of me. They've done all the right things. They've got a strong balance sheet. They've got, you know, well over £2 million in the bank at the end of the, that was the end of the 2019-20 season. So clearly COVID had started to impact upon Scottish football. But, you know, if you've got cash in the bank, that acts as a really good buffer. Yeah. So they've been superbly run. You know, I think they lost 20 grand that year, but overall they make profits more years than they lose, and they went all out in 2020 by spending £25,000 on players, which was the first time they've actually bought players for heaven only knows. So to achieve what they have achieved without spending money in terms of recruitment in respect of player transfers is an incredible achievement, and it shows what can be done. And I do think that Scottish football could perhaps teach English football a thing or two, because, yeah, as you know, I look at all of the clubs in both England and Scotland and Wales, of course. Okay. But Scottish clubs, they just say, this is our budget, this is what we're going to stick to. And they don't get breakaway owners who start an arms race in terms of wages which are not sustainable.
I suppose you could argue, though, that there's less, not less at stake, that's not the right word, but, you know, in Scottish football, only two clubs at the moment will ever win the Premier League. And the benefits of being in the Premier League are not probably quite as strong as they would be in English football, are they? So there's no need to break the bank or break your club to get out the Scottish Championship in the way that English Championship clubs are so desperate to do. Would that be a fair...
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The difference between the bottom of the Scottish Premiership and the top of the Championship is £500,000 in TV money compared to £90 million between the Premier League and the Championship. So, you know, if English football wants to address its problems, yeah, parachute payments aren't the problems. It's the gaps that are the problems. You address those and you get rid of parachute payments automatically, and we stop the, well, if I do go and sign this player and pay him 40 or 50 grand a week in the Championship, then he'll get me promoted and I'll become rich, because you're already at a much better financial position. So that's what we need to address. But yeah, that would mean that the bigger clubs in the Premier League, they'd have to give up some of their revenues, and there's no willingness from them to do so.
Yeah, and that is why the Scottish Championship isn't a basket case and the English Championship is a basket case. Thank you for listening, everybody. If you'd like to make a small contribution to our always free for air podcast, and that would be very kind of you, and you can do so by going to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And of course, if you have any questions for our next questions pod, which will be next Monday, then it's questions@priceoffootball.com is what you need to email. And before Kieran embarks on a weekend of domestic bliss, I shall hand you over to him for his customary farewell.
Thank you, folks, for the feedback. Thanks for I think Apple insists they can now call it following rather than subscribing, because subscribing implies paying money. And of course, the show is free to listen to and will always be the case whilst Kevin and I are here. Other than that, hopefully come on England by the time you're listening to this on Monday.
Or cheer up, everybody, there's always the World Cup.
Yes.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. The Price of Football. Price of Football.